I'm George Oriello from the University of Warwick, and I'm here with Dr. Adam Clulow from Monash University, and this is a podcast for the Warwick Knowledge Centre. Adam, we are looking at an image of a very interesting object, and if I'm not incorrect, this object is in Japan.
Yes, this is a 1636 brass chandelier, a very large brass chandelier that was presented by the Dutch East India Company, which was trading in Japan, to the Japanese shogun in 1636, and it still exists in Japan today.
Now, the Dutch East India Company, what is it?
The Dutch East India Company is a large mercantile organization. It's really the world's first multinational organization. It's founded in 1602, and it then proceeds to expand through Asia, and so it comes to Japan in 1609, and it's really sort of the forerunner of modern multinational corporations, and it continues to trade in Japan from 1609 all the way until the organization collapses at the end of the 18th century. So it's in Japan for a very long period, and it has a very close association with the Japanese shogun, so it presents gifts on a number of occasions, and this is really, without question, probably the most spectacular gift that is presented by the Dutch to the Japanese, and it's certainly the most successful gift.
Was it very common for the Dutch, and of course there are also other national companies like the English East India Company or the French, to give presents to the local rulers?
Yes, no, it's absolutely standard. So when the Dutch arrive in 1609, for example, they arrive in Japan, they arrive in the port of Hirado, and the first thing they do is they send an embassy to the Japanese shogun, and they carry gifts with them, and they present these gifts to the Japanese shogun. Now the problem is that the Dutch, as other Europeans, really struggle with the question of gifts. So when they arrive in 1609, for example, they don't have particularly appropriate gifts. So in 1609, they arrive in the port of Hirado, and immediately they discover they don't have anything to actually give the shogun. So they travel down 100 miles to the port of Nagasaki, and they proceed to buy something actually in Japan in order to give that to the shogun. So it's a sort of long process of experimentation, of trial and error, to try and figure out what gifts to give. And by the time you get to the 1630s, they're giving gifts virtually every year.
What kind of gifts would they have given to the shogun or other local rulers?
Well, it's a variety of things. The most successful gift that they gave prior to this is really sort of military technology. So they might give firearms on occasion, but probably the most important gift is cannon. So in 1615, for example, when the Dutch East India Company wants a concession from the Tokugawa shogun, they present a cannon. In 1627, when they want to lift a particular restriction, they present two cannon, actually, and these are large naval cannon. And these are particularly attractive to the Japanese because the Dutch have this unquestionable advantage in military technology. So prior to the 1630s, whenever the Dutch really want something, they're presenting a military item, usually a naval cannon, but there's actually a huge range of gifts. They might bring rare animals, for example, they might bring cloth. There really is a tremendous range of gifts.
Now, why did they go for such a peculiar and different object?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, this was presented in 1636, and it's essentially presented in order to secure a particular goal. So in 1628, Dutch relations with Japan are essentially ruptured. So there's a trading dispute on Taiwan. A Dutch governor on Taiwan actually arrests a Japanese merchant ship, and because of this, trade relations are actually suspended. In 1632, 4 years after this dispute, the Dutch essentially decide to hand over the offending governor. So the person who actually imprisoned this Japanese ship, they decide to actually hand him over to the Japanese shogun, which is actually an unprecedented thing that only happened once in the history of the Dutch East India Company. The Dutch East India Company then, after 1632, wanted to secure the release of this governor. This was a significant priority for them. And they really thought about how we can do this, what sort of gifts we can bring. And eventually they decided we should try something else. You know, we've presented cannon in the past. These are essentially utilitarian objects. Let's present a decorative object. But within the actual record, there's no account of the discussion. You know, this is why we decided to present this object. But it's clear that they decided that we should shift from utilitarian objects, from military objects, to decorative objects. So the first mention we see of this is in a 1634 record. The Amsterdam Chamber, back in the Netherlands, decides to buy this large brass chandelier, and they ship it all the way over to Japan, and it arrives in 1636. And it's a very different sort of object, but it's difficult to know the exact rationale. But I think it's that they sort of decide that they're moving away from these utilitarian objects to more display objects, to more prestigious objects.
Where did they get this chandelier, and how expensive was it?
It's a good question. This was made, we don't know exactly who made it, but looking at the style of the chandelier, we assume it was made by someone called Joost Gerritsen, who's a Dutch craftsman in the 1630s back in the Netherlands, and he makes a number of similar chandeliers. So if you look at paintings of Dutch Reformed churches in the 1650s, 1660s, 1670s, you'll see a number of these similar brass chandeliers. So this is a fairly standard item in the Netherlands, but it's really associated with churches. And as I said, if you look at any representation of 17th century churches, you'll often see these large brass chandeliers. So they approached Joost Gerritsen in 1634. They commissioned him to make this. He then produced it, and the official cost is 796 guilders, so close to 800 guilders. But we're not sure of the exact cost. 800 guilders would itself be quite a sizable sum. And it's a very large object. The actual object, when it was initially displayed in Japan, was displayed on a stand, which was 9 feet tall. So it's a very sizable object.
So it's transported, I suppose, reassembled in Japan and put on this very high. But does it have a function in Japan?
Well, it's very interesting because it's a Christian object. It's associated with churches. But of course, Japan in this period has forbidden Christianity, has banned Christianity. So it doesn't really have a Christian association in Japan. And they don't present it as a Christian item. They rather present it as a massive display item. So when, exactly as you say, it's disassembled, it's packed into crates, it's then shipped to Japan, it's reassembled in Edo Palace, the Shogun's palace, and in fact the Dutch then present a series of other gifts while standing in front of it. And it would have been an extremely brilliant object. So in 1636, when it was assembled in the Shogun's palace, from all the records we have, we know that it caused an enormous stir. People were extremely interested in it, but it was presented really as a display object.
Was the interest in this object due to the fact that it was made of brass, that it was a large metal object, and Japan is not a place in which you have a lot of metal?
I think that is certainly one of the reasons. It's presented in 1636, which is a very important date because it's the 20th anniversary of the death of Tokugawa Ieyasu, who's the founder of the Tokugawa regime. So in 1636, at the moment that it's presented, Tokugawa Ieyasu, who's the current shogun, has just finished construction of Nikkō, which is a major shrine complex which has been built to celebrate his grandfather's death. So in 1636, the chandelier arrives in Japan. It's presented to the Tokugawa shogun, Tokugawa Ieyasu, and he's actually just finished the construction of the shrine. So the first thing that he does is he takes this object and he puts it on display in Nikkō. So just to answer your question, I think the brass is certainly one of the reasons why it's so unique and so exotic, but it's really seized upon as a kind of propaganda instrument. So it's moved to Nikkō, which is this very large shrine complex, which is essentially built as a homage to Tokugawa power, and it's put on display in Nikkō. So if you were a pilgrim, you would walk into Nikkō, which is a shrine to Tokugawa power. You would walk up a series of stairs to the Yomeimon, which is the central gate in Nikkō, and you would pass by this chandelier, which is still on display today in an eight-sided structure. So it should actually be quite high up, but it's quite low down. So I think rather than they're particularly interested in the artistic value, they're much more interested in the propaganda value. And as you walked up these stairs to the Yomeimon, you would have seen this brass chandelier, and you would then have been left in no doubt as to the power of the shogun. And it's really my interpretation, a number of scholars share this, that this then provides a concrete marker of shogunal authority extending beyond the ocean to distant countries, compelling respect from distant peoples. And I think that propaganda value is why it's so successful. And it's not displayed in Edo. I mean, it's assembled in Edo, it's briefly displayed in the palace, but then it's moved immediately to Nikkō and displayed outside.
So it had clearly a successful item in terms of propaganda for the shogun. Yeah. Was it a successful item for the Dutch in terms of diplomatic relations in the short and long term?
Yes, it was tremendously successful. This was the most successful item that was ever presented by the Dutch to the Japanese. And in fact, if you look at the Dutch records from this period, they're just stunned by how successful this is. The actual goal is to secure the release of this Dutch prisoner, the Dutch governor, who's been held captive for a number of years. They present this in 1636, and the Shogun is so delighted with it that he immediately frees his Dutch captive, and he even goes one step further. He presents the Dutch with 200 bars of silver. So it is a tremendously successful gift, and it's actually extremely interesting how quickly it moves. It's presented in 1636, and within 2 months, it's on display in Nikkel. So in what I've written about this, I always say that this is just the right gift presented at just the right time to just the right shogun. And you can see that very clearly, and that the Dutch achieved their goal. This then convinces them that they've presented this in 1636. This then convinces them that they should present additional gifts like these large brass objects made in the Netherlands and then shipped over. So in 1640, they present a similar object, which is a standing chandelier. This is a hanging chandelier. In 1640, they present a similar chandelier, a more expensive chandelier. But the Shogun already has one, so he doesn't have a particular need for another one. So that's not particularly successful. And then in 1643, they decide to try again, and they present a huge brass lantern, something that weighs 4,000 pounds, that costs 16,000 guilders. So if you go back to this image, this costs about 800 guilders. The 1643 lantern costs 16,000 guilders, so it's much more expensive, and it weighs five times as much, over 4,000 pounds. The Dutch bring this. They actually decorate it with Tokugawa cartouches, so the symbol of the Tokugawa family that rules Japan, and they're very confident that this will secure them what they want. And in 1643, they want a lifting of trade restrictions. But in fact, the Tokugawa shogun has very little interest in it, because he has already a number of these brass objects. There is a very limited propaganda value to display. The difference between displaying one item or two items or three items, there's not a tremendous difference. So the Dutch get a tremendous shock that the 1643 brass lantern, this enormous lantern, shipped at an enormous cost and very, very difficult to bring over, has to be disassembled, reassembled, comes in eight very large crates. They're shocked that this achieves almost nothing. So the history of this item is particularly interesting in that the 1636 chandelier is so successful, but it really is a one-off success. By the time you get to the 1643 gift and the 1640 gift, these don't actually achieve very much.
Now, tell me about the long-term implications of this relationship between the Dutch and Japan. When does it end?
Well, it continues for a very long period, and this gift is interesting because it sort of marks the stabilization of relations. There's a period of rupture from 1628 to 1632. Relations are reopened in 1632, but the presentation of this chandelier, which is so successful, really marks the stabilization of relations. And so I argue in my book, for example, that this is a pivotal moment when the Dutch are really defining a new kind of relationship with the shogun. And it's very interesting that this brass chandelier really functions as a symbol of Dutch subordination to the Tokugawa shogun. After 1636, relations are really quite stable, and they continue all the way until the 18th century, when the Dutch East India Company goes bankrupt. But even once the Dutch East India Company goes bankrupt, its successor organizations take over the Dutch East India Company trading post in Japan. And so the Dutch are actually in Japan all the way from 1609 all the way into the second half of the 19th century.
Tell me, Adam, how did you research this topic? Of course, we have an object that is there on display in public view, but in terms of archival research?
I started off with the 1634 record when the Amsterdam Chamber purchases this object. And I should just say that this is a large brass chandelier. It weighs about 800 pounds. It has a central sphere at the bottom and 30 arms arranged in three rows of 10. The object today is discolored from age, but when it was presented, it would have been a brilliant bronze material. It has a series of arms. The 30 arms are shaped like stylized dolphins. So it's an extremely beautiful object. I should just say that up front. I became interested in this object by really looking at the accounts of the Dutch East India Company, the head of the Dutch East India Company trading outpost in Japan, kept quite detailed diaries, and they record the presentation of this object and they explain its success. But for me, the key thing was really to match those records, which essentially say we presented this object was very successful, to match those records with what is happening in Japan in this period. And I wasn't the first scholar to notice this connection between Nikkō, but I think what I've tried to do is really understand what this object means in Nikkō, where it's placed today. If you go to the object today and you look at the actual the sign, it essentially presents it as a mark of the friendship between the Dutch and the Japanese. Now, one could certainly understand it that way now, but in the 17th century, it functioned in a very different way. This was really a symbol of Dutch East India Company's subordination to the Tokugawa shogun. And this is an image that I took at Nikkō, and I was really struck by this image now. It's really presented as a wonderful example of Dutch-Japanese friendship. But in the 17th century, it really functions quite differently. And that's really trying to understand what it meant when it was presented and what it meant to both sides has really been the sort of question that has driven my research.
Now, this is in a way a unique object, but if for those of us who cannot go to Japan to see it, do we have similar objects in Europe that we can admire?
Absolutely. These are very common objects. In the 17th century, these were objects typically used to decorate churches. So in the 17th century, a wealthy guild, for example, would quite regularly present these sort of objects to decorate Dutch Reformed churches. And if you look at paintings in the National Portrait Gallery in London, for example, you can see representations of 17th century churches, the Great Church, the Huurterkerk in Amsterdam, for example, which have similar chandeliers. But these chandeliers are quite common across Europe. So recently I discovered in London that Southwark Cathedral has a very similar one. I'm not sure if it's made in the Netherlands or if it's copied from a chandelier that's made in the Netherlands, but it is an almost identical design, an almost identical shape, almost identical size to the one that was presented to the Japanese in 1636. And this was the first time I've seen one of these objects in its sort of natural home in a church. And when you look at the Japanese, the chandelier that was presented to the Japanese, it's in this eight-sided structure. It's in shadow, really. It's green from age. And it is an impressive object because it's so large, but it's not impressive in terms of its brilliance, in terms of its color. In fact, it's quite easy to walk past it and go straight to the Yomeibon, this gate that marks the entrance to the shrine, which is an absolutely gorgeous example of architecture. I was really struck then looking at the chandelier in Southwark Cathedral, which is actually polished, which is actually brilliant, just how magnificent these objects were. And one can really understand why the Japanese were so impressed by them. So I think going to Japan, one doesn't actually, it's fantastic to see it, but one doesn't actually appreciate just what an impressive, what a brilliant object it is. And if you go to a cathedral, you go to a church, particularly when the light hits it or when the candles are in place and you have the candles blazing and the light glittering off it, I was certainly astounded by what a spectacular item it is.
Thank you so much, Adam, for such a wonderful talk about this very intriguing object.
Great. Thank you, Georgia.